Hunt v. DeVita, Mr. Dunham.
Yes, go ahead.
I want to hang on just a minute. Well,
yeah.
It's like the changeover to tennis match.
Yeah. You can go ahead
now. Okay. I think the facts, the relevant facts are pretty simple. My client was absent from work for more than the six-month period that DeVita has, and it's what I call their absenteeism policy. When she exhausted that period of time, she was sent out a termination letter. We filed a complaint alleging the four Illinois elements for retaliatory discharge, and they, DeVita, asserted the absenteeism policy, and then we attempted to claim.
But now your argument is that they were concerned about her, that she'd file workman's compensation claim for her carpal tunnel syndrome.
Well, Your Honor, the record really isn't clear. We did file a second claim, and that was.
Well, what's your basis for retaliation? I thought it was retaliation for filing for or fear that she'd file a complaint for carpal tunnel syndrome. Wasn't that your argument?
Your Honor, our theory is that the policy itself is retaliatory on its face.
Okay, but the policy.
Well, first of all, I thought the same thing Judge Posner thought, that trying to tie this into retaliation required some consideration of the effort to get workers' compensation claims. But I have a very specific question for you. On page 4 of DeVita's brief, they say that between January 1, 2009 and March 3, 2010, DeVita terminated the employment of 334 employees who exhausted their 6 months of leave under the two policies. Are you contesting that statistic at all?
There's no question that the DeVita uniformly applies the policy to everybody that has gone beyond the six-month
so
rule.
If that's the case, I'm really lost to understand your theory of misbehavior of any kind, of discrimination or retaliation or anything. It's just a policy. You know, 6 months will carry you, and then you're gone, but you're gone as a voluntary exit person, not somebody who was forced out, so you can reapply if you want.
The Illinois courts in Grabs versus Safeway, and I'm probably going to mispronounce the name, Siakura versus United Steel and Hess versus Clawcar, all recognize that absenteeism policies can be used as a motive to discriminate.
They recognize that as a theoretical possibility. You've got to show that DeVita treats people differently based on whether or not they pursue workers' comp claims. Let me try to get at the same question from a different direction, which is, what do you think would be a legal policy regarding long-term absenteeism? What do you think would be required?
Ultimately, I think there's going to be some leeway. Obviously, the judge, in some cases, is going to be able to say, I can dispose of this on summary judgment. Other cases, I think the judge is going to have to let the trier of fact apply.
No. That's not the question.
Like 6 months
what?
Is not legal, but a year is? Or, you know, what's legal?
I don't think that I'm not prepared, and I don't think there can be a bright-line rule that says at some point in time this court or any court, Illinois court, could say a five-month absenteeism rule is
The length of time won't really solve the problem for you. What you've got to talk about is differential treatment depending on work-related injuries causing absences and other causes of absence. And here we've got a neutral policy that applies regardless and that apparently is applied neutrally. So what would fix that?
Well, Your Honor, I think if I could, and I'm not trying to evade the question, but in the Hess case, they set out language that, in that case, they said the absenteeism policy that the plaintiff had failed to make their case and upheld the discharge. But there was strong dictum in there that said that the plaintiff could establish a pretext.
There is theory, okay? The court, those decisions, as far as I can tell, have said there is this theoretical possibility. Well, none of them actually found a neutral policy that was discriminatory.
Is Sierra Curie?
And what would that look like? What would the evidence of pretext be when, as we see here, everybody apparently gets treated the same way?
If 99 out of 100 people that were let go under the absenteeism policy had filed workers' compensation claims, and in fact their injuries that caused them to run afoul of the policy were work-related. And that was exactly what happened in the Sierra Curica case. In that situation, the plaintiff was discharged under the absenteeism policy. And what happened was the insurer delayed the treatment, and treating physician testified that if the...
There they were playing games with the timing of the surgery and so on. And that's a pretty straightforward case. But now you're telling us that was a sort of individual case-specific problem. But you're now telling us this is not a case-specific problem, this is a problem with the whole policy.
Correct, Your Honor. And I asked, and Hess, one of the questions that...
What's wrong with the policy? I don't understand.
What's wrong? Yeah, what's wrong with this policy?
Because there's no business justification for it.
But I don't understand.
For letting people go after they've been gone for 6 months?
I asked DeVita's witness, what's the business justification for
but
the policy?
A company can't keep a job open indefinitely, can it?
Your Honor,
well, it's gone for 10 years.
I think, Your Honor, I think they can, in the sense that they admit, and that's one of the arguments that they forcefully present. Oh, my client could be rehired at any time. She was eligible to be rehired.
In other words, she hadn't been fired for misconduct or something. You know, if there was a job, if she was qualified, and so on. But I guess. This business justification argument that you're making, it seems to me blindingly obvious that companies might choose to shut off the period of time in which you have some sort of presumptive right to come back at something like 6 months or a year or, you know, some period of time. I just don't understand what's not understandable from a business point of view about that.
Your Honor, I have filed a number of these cases. I've taken a number of these depositions. The only business justification that's ever been offered of the employer's witness is the health cost of keeping unproductive employees on the roll. DeVita didn't offer that in this case. But then I asked the question.
What about this? Just management flexibility? I mean, surely, it seems like such a boilerplate answer to me. I guess I'm...
Your Honor, I think
people were unimaginative.
I have no doubt that if you had been the witness that had been tendered by DeVita, you may have been able to articulate some business.
That's what I would have said, management flexibility.
That's not what DeVita said. And now they say, well, we didn't notice him up under 30B6, but they did tender this witness, and they've never made the argument.
Ms. Velasquez,
yeah,
right?
That's your problem, though, isn't it? I mean, 30B, you didn't notice it under 30B6.
It's not a problem at all, in my opinion, Your Honor, because they did tender this as a management employee, and everything that lady said is an admission of a party opponent. And I asked her at the beginning of the deposition, are you prepared to give answers as to the business justification for this policy, and her answer was yes. And then I asked her the question, what's the business justification? She said, you didn't know.
But why is it, let me put it this way, this is an employment at will situation. And so I'm not even sure if she had said, we just felt like it, that in the absence of any evidence that there was retaliation because of the workers' comp invocation of rights or some other, you know,
I think
some other theory of retaliation, why couldn't she just say that's just what we'd like to do?
And I think possibly she could have, but that's not what she said. And that's not the facts that we have. In my brief, I asked, I mean, because I think that's where we're heading. I think that DaVita could say, we have a policy that if we learn you have a herniated disc, you're fired. Now, policy...
They've got ADA problems if they do that, right?
Maybe, maybe not. It's by no means clear to me, because they could say, look, we have certain lifting requirements on our job that we require of all our employees.
They'd get an injunction against that policy in a heartbeat under the ADA.
But if I bring a retaliatory discharge case under Illinois law and it's removed to the Southern District of Illinois, I lose on a retaliatory discharge case if this opinion is permitted to stand.
Well, you have to show that there's something that was being retaliated against, and unfortunately nobody seems to have known about her carpal tunnel work-related condition. People get carpal tunnel from yoga. They get carpal tunnel from all sorts of things. It's not always work.
My red light is on, but if I could answer briefly. The Sirikirka case, in that situation, because the plaintiff had to have the surgery, he ran afoul of the six-month, the absenteeism rule. In my case, my client had carpal tunnel surgery. Her doctor took her off work, and on its face, she ran afoul of the six-month absenteeism rule. And also,
What do you think the word retaliation means?
Your Honor, I think that the Illinois cases permit me to test the policy. This absenteeism policy.
I don't know what the word retaliation means. Okay, thank you very much. We'll hear from Mr. Plum.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Dunham. This is a tort claim that has a proof of causation element, and our position from the outset of this case is that Ms. Hunt cannot prove that the cause of her termination had anything to do with her exercise of rights under the Workers' Comp Act. She can't prove causation because the person who made the decision knew nothing about any purported or alleged conduct on her part to exercise rights under the Act. The person knew nothing about it. The second reason is that the policy itself, as already been discussed ad nauseum a little bit here this morning, is the sole reason that she was terminated. In fact, during her deposition, the plaintiff specifically admitted repeatedly, yes, I understand that was the real reason I was terminated. I understand that was the cause of my termination. I understand that was the truthful reason for my termination. And finally, she can't prove causation in this case because the fact is, the undisputed fact, this is not speculation as it has been argued by Ms. Hunt, the undisputed fact is she would have been rehired after her doctor released her to come back to work.
You just mean eligible. I mean,
no.
if the company had...
I'm sorry.
I mean, that's an extravagant promise because I don't see anything in the record of an offer of a job to her. She would have had to apply. You know, you would have had to see at that moment whether there was somebody with 20/20 hindsight, maybe you can say that, but it seems to me you don't want to get too far out on that limb.
There are two things. When she was terminated, because we consider this a voluntary termination, she was eligible for rehire. So that's one thing. But we also submitted an unopposed declaration by the person responsible for hiring people such as Mrs. Hunt. At the facility where Mrs. Hunt had worked. And her declaration is, if she would have walked in and asked for her job back after her doctor released her, we would have rehired her. They had a need.
Is she still eligible for rehire?
Yes, she is, in fact. And that would be a key fact that we would argue to a jury. If she walked in the door today, she would be eligible. She's still eligible for rehire. And
she might do that.
She might. Now, the issue at the time, just to clarify this, I don't want to get, as you say, you don't want to go too far down the field here. I think At the time, the likelihood that she would have in fact been rehired was as close to 100% as you can get, because at that time, there was a temporary worker filling her role, her job at the facility where she had worked. And the reason was is because, frankly, there was the expectation that Ms. Hunt would get well, her doctor would release her to come back to work, and she would get the job back. But once, and I don't remember the exact date, but there was a point in time in late 2010, I believe, that temporary worker did sort of become a permanent worker. And so if she walked in today and wanted a job, there would have to be sort of a different opening. But at that time, her job was still there. In fact, she admitted in her deposition, when I asked her, if you walked in there and asked for your job back, would you get it? Oh, yeah, probably I would.
Mr. Plum?
Yes.
Let me ask you about the issue about deposition conduct here.
Yes.
Do you think it's appropriate for counsel to confer with a witness on anything other than privilege issues while the question is pending?
No, I do not.
Did that happen in the Velazquez deposition?
I did not confer with her with respect to any questions that were pending. I did make a gesture to her. And
when she was asked to point to a portion of a document?
No. As
or
I,
something else?
I'm sorry?
Or was it something else?
Are you asking, was it something else that I gestured at?
Yes.
Yeah, it was something else.
What was it?
The Bates label.
Ms. Velazquez, why were you doing that?
Yes. Ms. Velazquez had never had her deposition taken before. And
were you doing that?
Because Mr. Dunham asked a question and referenced a Bates label number, and she looked at me not knowing what he was asking about. Okay. And I just pointed
to the
Bates.
What about this passage? If you could point out to me in the policy where it permits an employee to return to work even though the six-month limitation period has expired. Then Mr. Dunham said, Mr. Plum, do not point to language in the document. I'm entitled to her testimony, not yours. What happened there?
I don't recall specifically. I'm sorry.
Do you think it would be appropriate for counsel in that situation to assist the client or the deponent in finding the relevant portion?
No.
Okay.
Because that goes to the heart of helping answer the question.
It does. So what happened here? You're telling me you don't remember?
I don't remember. I'm sorry. That we laid that out in the brief in responding to the motion and at the lower court level. There were I know one instance concerned Bates labels.
That sounds pretty innocuous.
Yes.
These others don't sound so innocuous, frankly. Whether it's an abuse of discretion not to strike the deposition entirely is a different question. But in terms of district courts, the need for supervision of misbehavior in depositions, it's a pretty significant issue.
I understand. I absolutely understand. There was absolutely no intent of guiding or directing an answer.
Well, we'll see what it looks like.
Anything further?
I have nothing further. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And your time had expired, Mr. Dunham. So, no, we're going to move on. We're running out of time. Next case for argument is Ganassi.